This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Something super and something not so super on today's program. Later, we talk about the arduous task of hauling coal ash away from Duke Energy plants around the state. Communities on the receiving end aren't happy, and we get an update. But first, a big day in Carolina sports history. This is not the show that I wanted to do today. Come on. The 21-year-old Panthers and their appearance in Super Bowl 50 against the Denver Broncos. The Panthers did not win on the scoreboard. The game ended 24-10 Broncos. But that doesn't diminish this remarkable season. Am I selling this?
Oh, boy, okay. Yes. Yeah.
With only one loss aside from yesterday and the realization by this team, by fans, and by casual football observers that the Carolina Panthers are for real. Football fans have been consumed for weeks about this game, and the Panthers' time in the spotlight will most likely pay dividends as yet unknown. The game was seen on TV by more than 100 million people in the United States, not to mention viewers around the globe. But we're going to spend this part of the program talking to one of the people who was there in Santa Clara on the field for the game. Mike Solarte is sports director for Time Warner Cable News. He's still in Santa Clara. And he got up this morning to join us because I don't think you were out celebrating it last night, were you?
Oh, no. There was not much to celebrate last night.
Well, thank you for being here. Mike's here to tell us about the atmosphere this week in California and yesterday at the game and some of the X's and O's. And here in our Spirit Square studios, Eric Spanberg, senior business writer for the Charlotte Business Journal. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you, sir. Good to be here.
First, Mike, what happened?
Well, that's as open-ended a question as you can throw me. A lot of very good Denver defense, a lot of opportunities missed by the Panthers. You know, the turnovers were such a big factor. I mean, Denver scores 14 of their points off of turnovers. The sack fumble that was a touchdown, and you know, the fourth quarter turnover that led to the icing touchdown, and if you take those away, we could be talking about a much different outcome. But give credit to Denver. I mean, the Panthers never really got on track. They never really got their footing. They never really got to a rhythm, and a lot of that had to do with the defense that really attacked Cam Newton on all sides, and you know, just the quarterback pressures and the rush throws, and ultimately it was the turnovers that really hurt Carroll.
At the coin toss, we elected to receive so that we could take the ball in the beginning of the second quarter. Was that a mistake? Would we have been better off putting the offense in the first play of the game?
No, it's not a mistake. The Panthers have done that all season long. When they've won the toss, they've always chosen to defer, putting the defense on the field first. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, if they can set the tone, the offense gets into a rhythm, and then you're hopeful if you're a Panther fan that they're going to get maybe a score late at the end of the first half, and then they're going to get the ball right back to start the second half. So, no, not a mistake at all.
This is just me as a complete novice to this, because I don't really follow football that much, but you know, you had to kind of follow the Panthers this year, but it just didn't feel right even before the coin toss. I can't explain it to you, but I sat there watching the TV thinking, this is not good. There's something wrong here. Something is off. Did it feel that way there?
No, it felt like the pregame warm was good. The players were they were excited. They were focused. I mean, it wasn't a matter that Carolina wasn't ready. I don't buy that at all. After being as close to the guys as they was on the field during warmups and hearing the frame of mind that they were in, I mean, everything seemed normal. And it was just one of those things that you have to credit Denver and their defense. They drew up a really, really good game plan to keep the Panthers off balance. And if you think about it, the Panthers outgained them yardage wise. They had the ball for, you know, more time on the clock. Denver, their defense bent, but it did not break, and they didn't allow Carolina to score points. And you know, they gave everything up to the goal line. But after that, it was, you know, they, the Panthers just could not capitalize on opportunities.
So the Super Bowl is theater, and it's theater for the whole couple of weeks that you get ready for it. And I don't know when you arrived in California, but what did it feel like there? I read today in the paper that there were more Denver Bronco fans apparent on the streets in San Francisco and Santa Clara than Panther fans, and I guess that's understandable because we're 3,000 miles away and they probably have fans who live in the Bay Area who just migrated from Denver. But what did it feel like in that town?
We got into town a week ago Saturday, so we spent a good bit of time here in California, and on game day, you know, game day was the most noticeable day of fans for either team. And being on the field, there was an awful lot of orange in the seating area. And that's not a knock on Panthers fans. I mean, you know, Denver got the jump on everybody because if you think about it, they also had about a four-hour window which to try to lock down tickets because they played first when they beat the Patriots, the AFC Championship of the Panthers. You know, played after that, played the late game at night. So they had a jump on it, and they bought a bunch of tickets. And, you know, it had a road game feel from a Panthers standpoint, but, you know, in truth, it wasn't. And, you know, like I say, I thought Carolina, I thought he had plenty of opportunities, but Denver was just really, really good. And based on giving the trophy to the winner in that game, they were the deserving champion.
We've heard a lot about what the home games, the home playoff games, meant to Charlotte because they were played here, and we had a lot of beauty shots of the city shown on television and to a national audience because prior to that, most of our games were regional at best on Fox. And what this isn't Santa Clara, so you didn't get the beauty shots of Charlotte. But what does this mean? Had we won, or now that we've lost, what does it mean, Eric, to the city and to boosters of the city and people who try to attract business and visitors and residents?
Well, I obviously, like you said, if they would have won, it would have been a much bigger deal, much bigger benefit, because you'd have the victory parade tomorrow and you'd have all these things. But still, just being on that big of a national stage, I think, does pay dividends. I think the thing that strikes me about this season, other than the fact that, you know, what a fun ride it was and how well the Panthers played up until yesterday, is that, to me, this is the first year that Charlotte really felt like a football town.
Mm-hmm.
And sure, part of it's winning and people jump on the bandwagon, but also I just think, you know, you get 20 or so years in, you have a generation that's grown up on it, and now all of a sudden you actually see the stands filled with people wearing Cam Newton jerseys or Luke Kuechly jerseys. Remember, the fight for years was that there were Packer jerseys and Eagle jerseys and all these other longer established teams. So I think that's a benefit, and I think the other thing is that just having Cam Newton and the Carolina Panthers in the spotlight so much has, again, helped reduce the, now where is that again? Where is Charlotte? Now, I don't know if we'll ever get rid of the NC because it's something that we have to talk about forever, but I do think that it did further cement us in the national consciousness.
Well, it's you journalists that are doing that to us. I read over the weekend that in the AP style book, the Associated Press style book, it mandates that you put NC after Charlotte. What's up with that?
Yeah, if I was running the AP, I would strike that rule, Mike. I'll say it right now.
obviously they don't put Colorado after Denver.
Yeah, that's right.
Although we have a Denver, they should.
Correct. Yeah, I mean, we got a huge Denver. Are you kidding? Doesn't our Denver have bigger mountains? Come on.
So what's more important to economic development, having an NFL and an NBA team in a city, or having a Super Bowl champion NFL team and a winning NBA team?
Oh, certainly you get much more attention when you win. I mean, that's just it's a cruel world, Mike. I mean, they throw you on the side of the road pretty quickly. But as I said, because the season was so good up to this point and they flirted with an undefeated season, I do think there was enough national attention on Charlotte that it made a difference. Now, quantifying this stuff is always impossible, but I do think it helps.
So was yesterday just a bad day, Mike? I mean, was it the two-week layoff and they were tight? Were they nervous? Because, you know, this is the big stage and Cam's first appearance in a Super Bowl. Was there something like that going on? Or the sea of orange out there as opposed to half blue, half orange? What was going on there yesterday?
The truth of the matter is that Denver was just more opportunistic. You know, the Panthers led Denver in every major statistical category, but The problem was that the Panthers also led Denver in the turnover category, 4-2.
One of the play-by-play guys on television yesterday said that you can watch all the film you want to of these teams, and the Carolina Panthers probably gorged themselves on Denver videotape and film, but you can't get an idea of the speed of their defense by watching it. You have to experience it. Did that throw them for a loop?
Yeah, like I said, any number of things could have thrown them for a loop. But, you know, while Cam Newton may have been brief in his post-game comments, he wasn't wrong. They played better. You know, they were more opportunistic. They were more efficient. You know, being able to score points with thanks to their defense. That's something the Panthers have done all season long. And not that the Panthers' defense was bad. Denver's defense is just a little better. You know, they were able to capitalize on situations and put points on the board.
So we have some of these might be all of Cam's post-game comments. I don't know that they are all of them, but they are brief.
And don't blink or you'll miss them.
That's right, and it's hard to understand, but we're going to play what Cam Newton had to say to reporters from the NFL about the game yesterday.
Ron said Denver 2 years ago had a tough time. They bounced back. You take that to heart when you look at it.
Nope.
Is there anything Denver did defensively that, I mean, I know you've seen them, study them. Was it pretty much what you had seen on film? Was there anything different you think they put in for this game?
Nothing different.
That's it. No and nothing different. That's kind of the petulant sore loser, Cam, that from last season, I think. What happened? I know he was upset. I know that he was upset with himself, with his team, with a couple of the players on the team, but he reverted back.
He did. He went back to the sulky, pouting Cam Newton. And look, I know people are going to say he just lost the biggest game of his life and nobody wants a microphone in their face. That's part of it. When you're a professional athlete and you're a public figure and you're out hawking Under Armour and you're out hawking Gatorade and you're making a lot of money, part of the deal is that you have to stand up there and act professional when you have a bad day at the office. He had a bad day at the office, and if you could see the video of that, the body language is even worse. I mean, he's kind of slouched down. He's got his sweatshirt over his head, and it's unfortunate. Now, is it the end of the world? No, but it just didn't look real good, and we thought that he had kind of moved past this.
And it's the antithesis of what some people have come to find annoying in him, and that is that braggadocio, the dabbing, the Superman pull the shirt away kind of move. And I didn't see any of that yesterday, Mike. None of it, not even before the game. There was no joy coming from Cam Newton yesterday.
During the game, no. I mean, but the stuff that was taking place on the field before the game, the pregame warm-ups, Cam was still being Cam.
Okay.
And I understand Eric's point about, you know, he's got to be better in those situations. This is the first time Cam didn't fail on that stage. You know, early losses in the playoffs and whatnot aside, where it was, you know, hard to take. This is the third championship game that he's played it. And I mean, by championship, I mean the last game of the season. And he won a championship with Blinn Junior College. He won the national championship at Auburn. And this was his first shot at winning the Super Bowl. And this is the first time he failed on that stage. And, you know, it's a lot to take in. It's a lot to process. And it's certainly a lot to process of A, happening during the game, but then B, process after the game when you've had, you know, 10 minutes of cool down time and you have to go meet the media. And Cam was, you know, I mean, they put him out in front of the media.
We have to take a break, Mike. We're coming right back on Charlotte Talks. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Robinson Bradshaw, committed to providing collaborative legal solutions to the business community. Offices in Charlotte, Rock Hill, and the Research Triangle, robinsonbradshaw.com. The turbulent 60s were a breeding ground for social activists, Vietnam War protesters, environmentalists, hippies promoting free love, and more. Now, we are witnessing a new generation involved in movements like Occupy Wall Street and Black Lives Matter. Some are revisiting old battles, including voting rights and civil rights. Others have turned their attention to new causes, and we're going to hear about them and an attempt to bring activists old and new together on this program tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, as more states prepare to contend with the Zika virus, experts are looking for ways to mitigate risk and ensure the public has accurate information. The latest on the spread and risks of the Zika virus.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Mike Solarte, who is the sports director for Time Warner Cable News, and Eric Spanberg, senior business writer for the Charlotte Business Journal. We had less than a stellar season last season. This year was the antithesis of that, and that got us to the Super Bowl. We only lost one game. There were rumors that had we won yesterday, it could be argued that the Panthers, this Panther team, was the greatest NFL team ever. How did we turn it around from last season to this season? Let's talk about something positive.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was a terrific season, obviously, for them to go 15-1. They almost had an undefeated season, lost that penultimate game in Atlanta. I don't think a lot of people expected this, and particularly when you think back to training camp, they lost their number one receiver, mm-hmm. Kelvin Benjamin, to a knee injury, and there were a lot of questions about their offensive line. And as you said, even though they went to the playoffs last year, they were 7-8-1. They squeaked in a bad division, and then they lost in the second round. And so I think other than the players and the coaches, not a lot of people expected this. I mean, I figured it was a 7-9, 8-8 year. I was only off by, about 8 games. So don't trust me. But, you know, even as I was talking about Cam Newton and how bad that looked yesterday, that post-game press conference, I think you do have to balance that with, think about the ride this city has been on, the exuberance, the joy, not only that he played with, but this entire team. I mean, they were fun to watch. There were a lot of characters. And as much as fans get upset about not winning the Super Bowl, you don't get many seasons like this. Yeah. So there's a lot to be happy about you're a Panther fan.
Prior to yesterday's game, you had written that we went from being a plucky upstart to a dominant team. You sticking with that?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, they didn't dominate yesterday. And I mean, I certainly get your point. But look, they're a very young team. Cam Newton's 26. Luke Kuechly is under contract. He's young. The core of this team is in place. Now, there are no guarantees. You don't know if you're going to get back. But over the next 5 years, they've got a really good chance to be in the hunt. And you know, Mike, you've been here the entire 21 years. They had never strung together anything like this. And a lot of times when they would have a good year, then it was the next year they'd just fall apart. I think this team is built for endurance.
So, Mike, a winning team takes a lot of work from a lot of different people. Coach Rivera, defensive coordinator Sean McDermott, offensive coordinator Mike Shula, general manager Dave Gettleman, Cam Newton, Greg Olsen, Luke Kuechly, Jericho Kotcher, who didn't play very well yesterday, Josh Norman, others all brought something to the table. But every NFL team has great individuals. How did these people come together as a team with a capital T? Because that's what they've been all season.
Well, it starts with a head coach. In terms of how they play for each other and the message that's sent to the guys to try to, you know, build that chemistry and that camaraderie. And, PC, we ran on Saturday night's show on Time Warner Cable News on Jersey Mike Sports Night. Cam Newton, we used a soundbite that he gave on July 31st at training camp talking about the vibe of the room is different in a good way. And, you know, it's just a matter of everybody kind of banding together, and they have a very family-like atmosphere, and guys played for each other. They cared for each other. They wanted to do well for the guy next to them more so than for themselves, and that's where it starts. It starts at the top with Coach Rivera, in my opinion.
Was, you know, Saturday night, Cam Newton was named I think 48-2 was named the MVP of the season. Did that play a role? I mean, was it more embarrassing? Did it put more pressure on him out there as having just been named the MVP to go up against this Denver Bronco defense?
I doubt that. I really do. All the accolades, because I mean, Cam was a player of the week several times, you know, during the season, and he's no stranger to the spotlight, and I don't think that had anything to do with him the way he played last night. I think if you think that him being named the MVP added pressure or you know was part of it, then you're not crediting Denver and what their defense did at all.
There were a couple of moments, particularly early in the game, when the officiating looked a little specious. and maybe you couldn't see it because you were on the field, Mike. But they did the challenges
yes.
that Ron Rivera. Yes. It looked to me, if you looked at the replays, that he was right. Ron Rivera was right. The officials were wrong.
Rivera was right on one of them because they reversed it, and on the other one was the catch by
Jericho
Gotchery.
Looked like that was right, too.
And, you know, the funny thing about those kinds of plays is I bet all the Super Bowl parties in Denver, they thought that the refs got that exactly right. So, you know, I go back to what Mike is saying, to Mike Salarte is saying. The fact that Von Miller was living basically on Cam Newton's shoulder pads all day, I think that was really the big difference, and no amount of referee calls or anything else could overcome that.
You can't trust what the Denver Broncos fans say. They don't call that the Mile High City for nothing.
Legal. Legal.
All right. Dude, some people have been writing in as we've been talking, so let me share some of their comments. Dennis in Lake Norman, offense sells tickets, defense wins championships. Denver won. Would you agree with that, Mike?
To a certain degree. I mean, Denver's defense made plays, but when you look at the numbers and what the Panthers' defense did, it's not like they were asleep at the switch. I mean, Denver gained under 200 total yards for the game. You know, I mean, I think that's a pretty good indictment of their play. You know, Peyton Manning was held in check, and there was talk that he turned in the worst performance of a Super Bowl-winning quarterback. And I think that Carolina's defense is getting overlooked in this. You know, they had two takeaways of their own, and they kept the entire Denver offense under 200 yards. I mean, there were 14 possessions by Denver, and eight of them were three and out. You know, three downs and a punt. So, I mean, that's doing work. So, you know, the Panthers defense played well enough to win that football game.
George on Twitter writes, the post-game interview after losing is like your girlfriend breaking up with you and strangers asking you about it on national television.
I can't disagree with him, but you have to be prepared to be asked about the girlfriend breaking up with you.
Robbie in Asheville, does anybody know what was going on when the Broncos got the ball and three or four Panthers were standing around him and not tackling him? It was like they were waiting for the Broncos to run, and run he did. Sorry, I don't remember the exact time, but I think it happened in the second quarter. That's where they thought he had a fair catch.
Yeah, I think he's talking about the punt return. And, yeah, I have not – Mike, I don't know if you heard anything in the post game. I haven't heard anyone say whether they thought it was a fair catch, but certainly watching on TV, it looked like that was the reaction from the Panther players.
Well, my reaction was that I thought that Brad Norton got hit because he kicked the ball, and the next thing you know, he ended up on his face. And there was no flag in that regard, and I think a lot of folks were wondering what – I mean, you know, maybe why did that get, you know, why was there a call there? And I have to go back to look at my video to see if there was anything that closely resembled a fair catch signal. At this point, I honestly don't remember. So I couldn't accurately comment on that.
And Cam has come under some criticism for the moment in the game when the ball was knocked out of his hand, and rather than die, he started to dive for it, and then two other Bronco players were coming in, so he backed away. Isn't it the quarterback's job to protect himself from being tackled by two guys?
Yeah, and it was interesting. Phil Sims, who was the analyst on the game, his comment was, it looked like Cam decided not to dive in there, and maybe that it – obviously, we didn't hear it in his press conference because they never even got to that question. It looked like he backed away, and self-preservation in the case of a quarterback, a $100 million quarterback, is not something to be frowned upon, I don't think.
Yeah. Cal writes, it helps, of course, if receivers can keep staying open, but the protection broke down for Jake Delhomme back then, and nothing seems to have changed. It's getting to be a Panthers institution, along with untimely and unnecessary major penalties, which we had a number of yesterday. Tillman put Atlanta back from the psychological hole the rest of the team had created to offset the Falcon home advantage.
You know, I mean, I can't compare a team from 12 years ago to this. I mean, you can compare them, yes, but I can't say that they have similar characteristics. In fact, to me, the 2004 Super Bowl team, it was so out of the blue and lightning in a bottle, whereas this season, this team, as I said, yeah, as it went on, they were dominating the NFL. They weren't just squeaking by, they were dominating. So I don't agree with that in terms of this year's team.
And Eric on Twitter says, stop trying to find excuses for the Panthers. Denver played better, plain and simple.
Yeah, I think, Mike, we're going through the five stages of dying here. We
yes,
haven't
we
gotten
are.
To acceptance yet.
But given all the what you said earlier, Mike, about the yardage and stuff, did they just play better? Is that, or is there more to it than that?
No, I just think Denver was more opportunistic. I mean, they scored six. They scored a touchdown on their defense when they with the sack fumble in the first quarter. They picked up in the end zone for the score, and the fourth quarter touchdown was off of a turnover that put Denver in really good field position. And a couple of plays later, next thing you know, it's 24-10, and a game that was right there for the taking at 16-10 Denver, where Carolina hadn't played their best football offensively, and they were still just 6 points down. You know, that was, you know, when that turnover happened and Denver put the points on the board, that was pretty much it. So, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, offensively, Carolina moved the ball well. Denver bent, but they did not break. And that's where this game was decided.
I think Ron Rivera was one of the people that said one of the things that the Panthers needed to bring to yesterday's game was the personality of the team. And part of the personality of that team, I would argue the major part, the 99% of the personality of that team is Cam Newton. And the fact that he views himself not just as an NFL quarterback, but as an entertainer, which is where all the dabbing and the stuff in the end zone and the giving the balls away to little kids comes from. Yesterday, they stamped on that and put it about 20 feet into the ground. Can he come back from that? Will we see that same Cam Newton, that entertaining Cam Newton, that Cam Newton full of joy and youthful exuberance next season, or will that be muted because of what happened yesterday, Mike?
That Cam Newton, the one that you described, was named the league's most valuable player. It's not broken. There's nothing to fix there. He should continue to be that guy, in my opinion.
Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say, I mean, to me, and again, Mike, you mentioned a lot of people have been critical about Cam Newton and the way he celebrates on the field. To me, it's one of the most refreshing things. They call the NFL the no-fun league a lot because they have so many rules. They're so conservative about all these things. And I really love the way that Ron Rivera has allowed them to show their personality and for Cam Newton to sort of put the team on his back and get the crowd into it. And, you know, I think he's a terrific player, and I don't expect him to take some huge step backwards. I still think he's got to do some growing up in terms of dealing with losses. He didn't look good yesterday on the field, and he didn't look real good after the game. But this is not a huge, overwhelming, career-threatening kind of situation. It's a bad day at the office.
I suppose if I were on the other side of all this, if I were a Falcon fan, well, we lost to the Falcons. That's a bad example. If I were the other team's fan, I wouldn't like what he did. But what he does seems to be different to me than a lot of the hot-dogging that you've seen from other players in the NFL. This seems to be hot-dogging with joy, if that makes any sense. Just the joy of being there in the moment on that field playing that game, that's what it seems. And I think if you can be that joyful about your job,
oh, absolutely. And the thing is, and, you know, Mike Solarte can chime in on this, too. Look, I have two kids. They love Cam Newton. All kids love Cam Newton. I just think that, it's something that may rub adults the wrong way. Adults can go one way or the other on it. But, boy, you look at young fans, they just eat it up because of that smile and the personality. And it's not just drudgery of carrying the ball in the end zone. I mean, he's really fired up. And he looks like a kid a lot of times. And I think all that stuff is terrific for the NFL. I really do.
Mike?
Yeah, My perfect, I agree with everything Eric said. I mean, the folks that don't like Cam Newton for all the dabbing and the dancing, they're just never going to like the guy. I mean, you're never going to like that version of the Panthers that played the 2015 season, because they play a very, very intense physical game. And when they do something positive, they smile and they celebrate and they hand the football to a child. I don't know what there is. There's nothing. You know, I don't know what there is to dislike about that. And if you, I mean, go check my Twitter feed. Yesterday I posted, or Saturday night when he was named the league's MVP, I posted a video where he stopped for 30 seconds on his, on Christmas Eve to say hello to my wheelchair-bound stepson and put a smile on his face, just as CJ and my stepson put a smile on Cam's face. That's the side of Cam that a lot of people don't really get to see, and it's unfortunate, but, you know, Cam is Cam. This team was fun to watch. They were entertaining. They were incredibly talented on the field. I'm going to take away the 2015 season. It was just one game, or 1 year, where they just did not land the plane. That's really what it comes down to. They didn't play well enough against Denver to claim the Lombardi Trophy.
So we have a long layoff now between now and the first preseason game. What do they have to do to maintain the team nature of their effort going forward, to maintain the momentum that they had up until yesterday? What do they have to do?
Well, they've got decisions to make about the roster, but I think that for those players that played and that were around this team all season, that, you know, watch this game go away and see their opportunity to win the title go away, this is going to be a team that's going to have a shorter offseason, and I think they're going to come back even more focused than ever because they got a taste of it. And once you get a taste of it, you want more. And I think these guys want to be the ones on the field standing there with all the confetti falling around them and enjoying the championship aspect of it, as opposed to leaving the field dejectedly like they did last night.
If you look at sports, Mike, a lot of times it is a process of nibble, 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 and then you finally get the big meal. I mean, I don't know if you remember, but there was a time when people wondered consistently whether Michael Jordan could ever win a championship.
I don't remember.
Yeah. And he only won.
I grew up watching those Bulls teams in Chicago. I remember them getting beaten by the Boston Celtics, the Detroit Pistons, being so close and not getting there.
And you know, national columnists would write, "Yeah, I just don't know if Michael Jordan has the right makeup to lead a team." And then he only won six, so clearly he didn't have any capability of winning championships. So, but you know, you see teams, they get to the playoffs, they get to this round, to this round, to this round, and what you hope happens is that exactly what Mike Solarte is saying, is that they get motivated even more, and they come back and they finally win that championship. And I think with the young core, they've got a good chance to do that. The other thing I would mention is, you know, the NFL long ago became a year-round business, even for fans. So in 2 weeks, fans are going to start talking about the draft prospects, and then you go into the draft and mini camps and training camps. So it won't be long before people are talking Panthers again, probably with a little bit more enthusiasm after what was no fun yesterday for Panther fans.
No, it was no fun. I think part of the problem also was the game was on CBS. No, our games have been on Fox,
right?
most
Yeah, you're right.
And the graphics are different. The announcers are different. Yes. The camera angles are different. They were not our guys, the CBS
Jim
people.
Nance and Phil Simms put the hex on the Panthers. Mike Collins reporting live.
That's right. Eric Spanberg from the Business Journal and Mike Solarte, the sports director for Time Warner Cable News. Michael, thanks for getting up early and being with us this morning. I appreciate it.
You bet, guys. Try to get through the day and stay away from the ledges.
That's Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Tyndall Subaru Gastonia. Test drives are available for the new 2016 Crosstrek SUV with EyeSight safety technology that sees problems and initiates action to help avoid trouble. Details at TyndallSubaru.com. As parts of the U.S. prepare to contend with the Zika virus, experts are looking for ways to mitigate risk and ensure the public has accurate information. So on the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock, the latest on the spread and risks of the Zika virus. When we come back, we're going to talk about something as depressing as we've been talking about this entire program, but on a whole different page. Coal ash removal. Stay with us.
Yeah. It's your world. We help you explore it.
Walking down a long corridor to our waiting driver took us out into an Iran just relieved of economic sanctions.
It's your community. We help you understand it.
An attorney for the North Carolina NAACP put it this way in her closing argument. The ID requirement is a double whammy for minorities.
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. I should mention that song that you heard, a little piece of the song that you heard. We were going to play more of it had they won, but that was Keep Pounding by the Bodacious Wicked, featuring Brody and Chach, Black Costume, and Red Jesse. I wanted to bring that up. It's a locally produced song about the Panthers. Well, from a Carolina low to a Carolina low. Coal ash has been with us since we started burning coal to produce electricity, and ever since that ash has been building up, tons of it for 100 years. It went unnoticed for the most part until coal ash spill from a pond at the Duke Energy Dan River plant 2 years ago. That spill focused attention on the environmental hazard posed by this byproduct of electricity production at coal-fired plants, and now the job of hauling it away is picking up momentum along the Dan River and at other facilities, including one just outside Charlotte. That ash has to go somewhere, and communities on the receiving end aren't happy about receiving it. Still, there are timetables for removal of the ash, and the courts have weighed in on who oversees that cleanup, and we're going to get an update on all of this from WFAE's environmental reporter David Borax, who has been following it all. Welcome to the program again.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. The Dan River spill was 2 years ago. Since that time, you've been at some of these coal ash sites. Most of us have not. What's it like?
Well, I have had a chance to visit some of these sites, and you're at the scene of an old coal plant. In about half the cases, Duke has retired the plant, so they're actually in various stages of being dismantled. But what's around the plant are a couple of different ways that it's being stored. In some cases, it's a mound that's covered with dirt, and it's got green grass growing on it. In some areas, there are trees and woods that have grown up on top of it. Mm. But the biggest issues have come at coal ash basins or ponds, which in most cases are next to waterways. And these are literally ponds where the sludge, the coal ash is mixed with water and sent down a sluice into these ponds and allowed to settle out. And then the water is eventually cleaned and sent back into the waterways. The reason that these plants are next to waterways, and it was for good reasons at the time they were built, is that a coal plant burns coal to heat water, which is turned into steam. So they needed a good supply of water. But that's not such a good thing when you're talking about storing what's left after you burn coal.
Yeah.
And the coal ash has been an issue now going back many years.
How many of these storage ponds or these sites where they store coal ash have problems that we know about?
Well, Duke has 14 existing or retired coal ash plants, and there's about 32 of these coal ash basins that are at these plants. How many of them have had problems? You know, Duke will cite some, and there have been some issues that have gotten into legal cases. If you ask an environmentalist, they'll tell you every one of these is an issue. So they are in the midst of starting to clean these up. You know, you mentioned before that there are some around us. There are at least four that are not too far from us here in Charlotte. There's the River Bend plant in Mount Holly on Mountain Island Lake, which is northwest of Charlotte. There's the Allen Steam Station in Belmont, the Marshall Steam Station at the north end of Lake Norman, which is still operating. And then there's the Buck Steam Station on the Yadkin River in Rowan County. And some of these are among the most serious and high-risk coal ash sites around the state.
So we've lived with coal ash since we started burning coal to make electricity. Why now? Are we suddenly so concerned about this? I mean, I know the spill alerted everybody, but why have we had problems all along that we didn't talk about, didn't know about, no one reported on? Why now?
You know, it's the story of the developing environmental awareness. I mean, when coal plants were first built, what did we do with the coal? We burned it, and it went straight up through those smokestacks into the atmosphere, and most of the residue from coal was sent off into the sky as what's called fly ash. When we began to become aware of air pollution and that issue, we started putting equipment on the smokestacks that captured that fly ash, and allowed them to remove it and put it into these basins and mounds and that sort of thing. You know, our understanding of this has evolved. Now we're at a kind of further down the road, and we understand that actually where we're storing this coal ash is not so good. And we learned it not only from the Dan River spill a couple of years ago in North Carolina, but from an even larger spill in Tennessee in 2008 at Kingsport, Tennessee, where a billion gallons of this stuff was spilled over 300 acres, and it was pretty serious.
So here's Sam Perkins, who is the Catawba River keeper. Here's what he has to say about it.
The case really with all 14 sites in the state, but especially for the three sites along the Catawba around Charlotte, is they are propped up right on the banks of these lakes that serve as drinking water reservoirs. So you not only have ongoing contamination of groundwater and ultimately surface water and the lakes themselves, you have a very dangerous game of toxic Jenga going on, because if any of these were to collapse, if you even saw a relatively small spill, it would be quite the crisis for the drinking water suppliers downstream. There aren't really alternatives in our basin.
So there's a problem on the storage end. There's a problem that we'll talk about a little bit later on the receiving end as to where they're moving this coal ash. And what about in between as they move it? How is this stuff being moved from place to place?
So I have been both to Dan River, which is on the Virginia border, and to the Riverbend Steam Station here northwest of Charlotte. And in both of those cases, what Duke has done is they've built new train lines, rail spurs, into these plants to transport this to landfills that are kind of far away. They've also been transporting this stuff by trucks. And the reason that they've built these rail spurs is that, of course, an 85-car train can carry about as much coal ash as about 420 truckloads. Oh. So it's a lot more efficient. And the trains themselves are they are covered with plastic covers so that the stuff doesn't fly out. I think, you know, as far as the trip along the rail or the roads, it's probably not that serious a problem. I mean, most of this stuff is not airborne. It's, you know, it's wet and it doesn't fly around too much. But it is being delivered to these landfills in other parts of the states.
When we first started talking about this, somebody said that you could have a steady stream of trucks at each of these locations, filling themselves up and driving away and then coming back. A steady stream, and it would take decades to empty these ponds. How much quicker does using a train at the Dan River plant, for instance, make the removal?
Well, remember, Dan River and Riverbend and a couple of other plants are on this high priority list in North Carolina, so they've actually got a deadline of 2019 to get this stuff removed. Presumably, Duke has done the train and rail solution to meet that deadline. So I guess, you know, maybe not decades, but it could be another several years before this stuff is out of the way.
So what do environmentalists have to say about the cleanup itself? Do they think this stuff should stay where it is? It should be moved? And if moved, where?
It's interesting. The environmentalists are not of one mind when it comes to moving this stuff. At this point, the state has chosen one solution, and that is to send it by rail and trucks to central North Carolina to this couple of old clay mines. Not all the environmentalists agree with this. The people who are on the receiving end of this don't like it. But one of the people I talked to was Frank Holloman. He's executive director of the Southern Environmental Law Center. And he is kind of the same mind as Sam Perkins from the Catawba Riverkeeper, that the best thing to do is to get this away from waterways.
We have urged Duke and other utilities across the Southeast to remove that ash from these dangerous, unlined, leaking sites and move the ash to appropriately designed, lined, monitored landfills away from the waterways with the ash stored dry, which eliminates the risk of catastrophic failure at the Dan River, and virtually eliminates any risk of pollution of our rivers and lakes and drinking water supply.
So that describes the solution that Duke and the state of North Carolina are using right now for the highest risk sites. Coal ash is being excavated. It's being put on these trucks and trains and shipped to these new landfills. In North Carolina, it's going to Chatham and Lee counties. They've built a couple of new landfills at these old clay mines where clay was once mined for brick making. And Holloman likes that. But other people don't like that, especially the folks who live around it. And I talked to Lou Zeller. He's the executive director of the Blue Ridge Environmental Defense League. And his group is working with some of those residents around those two old clay mines. And they think that the whole drive to clean up these sites is moving too fast. Zeller's group is challenging the state's decision to issue those permits.
Yes, the core of our objections has to do with the state kind of riding roughshod over environmental regulations. And certainly there's a problem with coal ash, and the trigger for that was probably Dan River disaster 2 years ago now. But I think that part of the problem is that the legislature has dipped in and put an accelerated schedule on it, and it's causing officials in the state to want to sweep the ashes under the rug as quickly as possible and get out of the headlines.
When we first started hearing about coal ash, we heard that it was never classified by the EPA as a toxic substance. Hard to believe, but that's true. I don't think they still classified it as a toxic substance, have they?
Actually, within the past couple of years, they've had to make a new ruling about this because, you know, this is not just a North Carolina problem. This is a problem
all over the country.
Nationwide, there's over 1,000 plants and, you know, thousands of sites for this stuff. But the EPA did rule that it is not a toxic substance. And that may have been a scientific ruling, or it may have been a ruling of convenience, because if it had been labeled as toxic, that would have thrown a whole new monkey wrench into the efforts to move this across the states and out of states. So I think that's been an issue there.
And yet, North Carolina regulators released classifications for various coal ash ponds in December of last year. What do these classifications mean? Low, intermediate, high risk. Is that to the removal process? Is it to the storage situation? What do those things mean?
So after Dan River, the state legislature passed the Coal Ash Management Act of 2014. And this was an effort by the state to get a handle on what's going on and to figure out a new way to store this stuff. In the act itself, actually, they identified these four high-risk sites, including Riverbend and Dan River. But they also set up a process under which the State Department of Environmental Quality would come up with a new ranking for the remainder of the 32 sites around the state. And they're looking at water quality near the plants and whether the coal ash itself is seeping into water supplies. And that's been a little bit of a holdup. The State Department of Environmental Quality was supposed to have a final priority list by the end of the year, 2015. They came up with most of a list on December 31st, but they said, we still don't have enough information about water quality at some of these sites. And so we're still waiting to hear on that. But anyway, those rankings are going to determine how things come together. What we ended up with was five high priority and the rest being lower risk. And what that affects is how soon Duke will have to clean these up. So the high priority sites have a 2019 cleanup date, and the rest are in a couple of different groups going up to 2029.
And some of the highest risk sites, the coal ash is being moved from where they stored now into these clay mines that you talked about. Does the storage location that they're moving that stuff to have anything to do with the toxicity of the coal ash in the ponds, or just the fact that they needed to get it out now and that's what's available to put it in?
It's those high-risk sites are deemed to be that because of the risk of contamination on the original plant sites. So
there's also some speculation about the cozy nature, that, as it has been described, between the state and regulators and Duke Energy. Teresa Vick, who is a community organizer with the Blue Ridge Environmental Defense League, says she thinks state officials are too cozy with the utility and have inappropriately speeded up approvals.
The recent dinner with the governor that was held on June the 1st last summer with Donald Vandervaart and the governor and Duke Energy CEO Lynn Good and others, lawyers, was 4 days before the final permits were issued for these two sites. 4 days before.
As I mentioned earlier, the Blue Ridge Environmental Defense League is challenging the permits for these sites. And when the information came out in a news report last summer about this meeting, they've actually added this to their complaint now, and they're trying to get attention for the possible, implications of a meeting where high-level officials from Duke Energy and the state may have met to discuss this issue. We did get a chance, and Duke Energy has responded. We got a chance recently to talk to CEO Lynn Good of Duke Energy. She isn't really saying what happened at that dinner, but after a speech in Charlotte last month, reporters asked her about that meeting.
Lynn, what did you and the governor talk about at that dinner at the executive convention last summer?
You know, Bruce, we meet with leaders around the state all the time, whether it's important stakeholders in the environmental community, whether it's legislators, regulators, or the governor. It's ordinary course for us. We're an important part of the state. We want to be engaged with our leaders.
Did you talk about coal ash?
We talked about a broad range of things, and it's part of our outreach to stakeholders, as I said a moment ago.
So is there transparency with what's going on, or is there not transparency with what's going on, or do we know?
I'm not sure we totally know. Maybe this will be one of those things that comes up in an administrative hearing somewhere, but highly unlikely that we'll actually ever find out.
Who's paying for all of this?
That's a great question. So I heard somewhere else this morning that this may cost Duke Energy about $4 billion, and I've talked to folks at the company. The Dan River cleanup, the bad spill that caused environmental problems up there, the emergency cleanup was paid for by Duke and its shareholders. But the rest of this, we use this electricity over the 20th century, and we're going to have to pay for this in our bills.
David Borowax, our environmental reporter here at WFAE News, will update on the removal of coal ash from ponds scattered around the state. Thanks for joining us.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of